Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, everyone. I am Leona Abraham Brando, host for Blog Talk Radio, Shedding Light. Lawrence and his wife, Samantha Drank, are back with us today to speak on Lawrence's negative and positive experiences, bringing him to the level of achievement he has now acquired. Lawrence, at the age of 9 years old, had been abused and was an acting out child, which ultimately led to his being placed in over 25 foster homes, where he experienced more abuses and where coping skills were at its lowest, ultimately resulting in imprisonment. Lawrence, now on a mission, is determined to prevent others from going down the same path. He is in the process of starting his own nonprofit organization, and he's been speaking out on radio, YouTube, and other media outlets to bring awareness, improve the penal system, and prevent others from going down that same beaten path that resulted in his incarceration for 20 years. It has been very difficult for not only Lawrence, but for so many others who have come out of prison trying to start all over again. It's very difficult because of the Coreys. So people that are trying, when they come out, to be able to do what he has done, and there have been some others that have done the same thing, is admirable. We also want to remind everyone that prisoners should not be stereotyped, because there are so many people in prison because of being stumbled, because of past traumas, because of wrongful convictions, because of victims, prisoners becoming offenders, only becoming offenders after being victimized themselves. There are so many different reasons, and we will find out about some of them as we go along. We have an hour show today, and we hope that we can get everything in this hour. So, Lawrence, are you on with us? No, we have Christine on, and who else is on with us? 1176. Christine, do you want to introduce yourself?
Hi. My name is Christine Brady, and I'm Lawrence's sister-in-law.
Okay. And you're Samantha's sister, then?
No, I'm his brother's wife.
Oh, okay. It gets confusing sometimes. Okay, so your support, you know something, it's good to know that you're on, because there's a lot of family members. When people go into prison, there's a lot of family members that back away, turn their backs. You know, they're not there for their loved ones. And when they come out, it's almost like starting all over again. But to see the sister-in-law coming on, that's admirable too. So we have someone, 805 number. Do you want to introduce yourself? No, I guess not. Lawrence is not on with us yet, so I'm going to speak a little bit more on these things that are happening in the prisons and things that have happened on the outside. There are a lot of people in prison who have grown up in ghettos and in poor areas. There are some that have grown up in upper class areas. The raising, the bringing up, the things that they experience, a lot of this plays into part. We have cultures. We have cultures in the homes. We have cultures in the streets. We have cultures in the schools, the churches, someone else's homes. We have them in the prisons. We have cultures in nursing homes. And we have cultures all over. And a lot of people don't understand, when we talk about culture, it's not about races all the time. Sometimes there's two people in one house that can be so different. The situations are so different. So not everyone under the same roof is exactly the same. Some of those that are under someone's roof, one could be having some serious difficulty, some psychological problems they're trying to deal with, or some addictions, while another member of the family can be perfectly fine. People don't look at these things. sometimes people are, these young people are abused as children, either sexually or physically abused as children, especially if it's a boy, because they're afraid to speak out. Girls too, but boys feel that it takes something from their manhood as they get older. And a lot of these prisoners have not spoken about these issues because they have been too embarrassed, too afraid, too low self-esteem, whatever it might be, they have been afraid to speak out about it. And these are some issues I hope everyone will listen to and look at.
Sorry to interrupt, Leona. Lawrence is telling me that he's 1176, the 805 number.
Pardon?
Lawrence is telling me he's the phone number 1176.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, so I think he's on.
But he's not, I can't hear him. Lawrence? Let me try something here.
Oh, there you are.
Okay. How are you,
okay,
Lawrence?
Okay, cool. I'm good. I'm sorry. I lost the thing, so I just had to call in. I couldn't find the email.
Oh, okay.
I wouldn't let you down.
Well, you know what? Sometimes we do have problems with the volume, and I don't know why, but they said sometimes you have to sign out and then sign back in again or hang up and call back again. But, Lawrence, do you want to talk a little bit about yourself again as far as the traumas that you went through as a child?
Yes, absolutely. Thank you. Thank you, Christine, for that too. The trauma that I've experienced as a child with not having the necessary tools, it kind of created not like a sickness, but a lack of. And so I learned coping mechanisms that I thought were normal because it fit my lifestyle. And the sexual molestation that I endured from the people that were supposed to raise me and I was supposed to trust, it taught me to not trust anybody. It taught me that if I wanted something done, do it myself, that I couldn't depend on anybody. And it also, you know, when the woman that's supposed to be nurturing you and loving you and give you all these needs as a child, and she's the biggest perpetrator in your life and allows all these things to happen, the physical abuse, the sexual abuse, the mental anguish, it actually disconnects you. And it, me growing up, I had no boundaries. I objectified women. I didn't trust anybody. It was something that later on really hindered me growing up to be a decent human being. So, and then eventually going to prison, it didn't help. You know, the prison atmosphere kind of fed this antisocial behavior. It fed the anger. It fed just the disconnect from the human race, and it created a monster. It really did.
You know, that's the one thing that I find too, a lot of times, and I want to ask you about this. When these things were going on in your life, did you have anyone to talk with, or did you try to talk with someone? What were your feelings at the time that you were going through all these traumas?
Well, I remember me being molested at, I think, 6 years old was the biggest thing, and that happened by my uncle. And that was something I thought was normal at first until I went to school, and they said, hey, is this, you know, if you've been touched, this is not normal, this is inappropriate. And so I really felt I wanted to talk to somebody, but nobody understood the life I was growing up in, the environment. So I tried reaching out, but I didn't know how to, because once again, I didn't have the tools to say, hey, I need help. I didn't even know the words, I need help. I thought it was just normal. I was ashamed. It was, I normalized it. And so it really hindered, like I say, reaching out to people. And it was something I was trying to hide, and I piled a bunch of crap on it so nobody would really know what was going on.
You know, when I talk about stereotyping prisoners, and I say that not everyone's alike, I believe the reason I relate to you so well is that it happened to my loved one, and he's serving a long time in prison. It happened when he was 6 years old, and it was by an uncle-in-law. It wasn't by his uncle, but it was by an uncle who is married to his aunt. And these are things that are happening in prisons, but he never told anyone for 16 years. He was too embarrassed, too afraid, and it was humiliating, you know, to have to deal with something like that. But this is why I'm glad you're talking about these things, Lawrence, because if it happened to you and it happened to a loved one of my own, I'm sure that there are so many people out there, maybe in the audience, who have a loved one that has been, and sometimes they have not even exposed or disclosed yet. There are people in the prisons that are probably not even talking about what they went through in that manner because it's humiliating for a male.
Oh, yeah. I think it's humiliating for anybody, and
yeah.
Especially for men in a prison environment. But the stuff that people don't realize is that, you know, when you have these experiences and you form a belief, an emotional response, you form like a persona about yourself. And a lot of times violent folks is because they're hiding something that they're ashamed of, and they want people to stand back. They want them not to get close enough. And they, you know, I didn't start talking about this until I think I was 32, and I'm only 38 right now. So it's one of those things that I put so much energy trying to hide this and not wanting to tell anybody that later on it just kind of shaped and molded a disconnected human being. And that's why today I just got ordained as a minister. And so because what I wanted, huh?
Congratulations.
Thank you. And I was the reason why I did all this, because I started my own business, Legacy Education, Legacy Programs Education and Reentry, is because I wanted to give every possibility to be able to reach out to the families and the victims and the survivors. And because I have a story and these credentials and this opportunity gives me the possibility to maximize reaching out and getting these people and giving them help. So I offer help for families. I offer help for survivors and victims. And I think that for us to heal the community, that we have to go back to it to reach out and to be vulnerable and to show people that, hey, we could relate. And that, I think that's the first step. I don't believe in the therapy, the whole thing of going to see a therapist. I think that's more of a punishment, and that it's so formal. I think that the community around us could heal each other. And I think I'm trying to take the first step and be that example and role model of today.
I think that therapy is necessary in many cases. And the community, as you say, the community can do the healing. But is the community ready? Unfortunately, we have people in the communities that are judgmental, that are really fearful of prisoners, because this is what the Department of Corrections officials try to make. Because of the prisons for profit, they want to keep these prisoners incarcerated as long as they can because they're making money on it. So they put it out there to make prisoners look much, much worse than they are. But I also wanted to ask you, when this happened to you, I know that my own loved one, and I know others have, they kind of like put their guard up. They do everything to focus on something else. They either lift weights, or they end up going into drugs or alcohol, or they end up doing, you know, some things that just to keep their guard up. They're afraid to date. They're afraid to get involved with a woman because they don't feel that they're worthy enough. These are also some. When this happened with you, did you go through any of that?
Oh yeah, the drugs and alcohol were a symptom to an illness, and I built this arrogance about myself that was standoffish from people that I didn't realize until somebody pointed it out. I think I was 34, and somebody goes, you know, Lawrence, you're pretty arrogant. And I had to explore that, because with every belief comes a mannerisms comes a mannerism with it and forms a habit. And I formed it from the belief that I didn't want people to be so close to me or find out my secrets. I had these mannerisms that portrayed a perfect life, that portrayed I'm just a pretty boy going about my business. And before too long, it just had a habit. I formed a habit into it. So even when I wasn't trying to disconnect from people, today I still have to catch that because it's such a part of me now that if I don't catch it, I end up, people go, are you mad at me? Did I do something? And it just comes off as like just a total disconnect from people.
Yeah. I know in my case, it was he turned to weightlifting. He did everything, working, school, weightlifting. He just wanted to keep busy all the time. And as a result, when he entered into a first relationship in his last year of college, he ended up letting his guard down, and he got involved. And then he learned that he disclosed to the wrong person. But these are things that happen. People put their guard up. And sometimes if they let their guard down, their whole world falls apart. But again, what you're doing right now in getting the awareness out there. But I believe that if somebody does go for counseling, if they do go to a psychologist, I think unless their psychologist has been there and overcome, I don't see how they can help someone that has gone through some kind of trauma or psychological issues like that.
Well, and that's the thing is, I believe that that it's good for some people. It just wasn't good for me. Me, I feel it's a punishment, and I'd rather, I don't want somebody just listening to me. I want somebody to understand me. I believe that this movement that I'm trying to, where the community comes together and heals its own, that we don't have to rely on the state so much, because we rely on the state and we give them the power and the authority to kind of distance us with fear and disconnect. And I don't agree with that anymore because I've been part of the system my whole life. I don't believe in just giving somebody medication because they think it's going to help without assessing all the essential issues at hand. I don't think it's a one-size-fits-all that you could just put somebody on some anti-depression medication and say, okay, you're all fixed. That's not part of it. I think that with the community getting involved, it's more powerful and effective because you're feeling part of something. You're feeling you're being brought into the loop. And I think that that's where the healing comes from. For some people, this may be great. But for me, I want my community to heal me. I want them part of the process.
I would love to see the communities get more involved. But, when I go on Facebook and I see even advocates who they click on like all the time. But when there are things going on, like making phone calls, groups are talking about, let's make phone calls to the politicians. Look at the month of January. January was supposed to be a month of daily calling to politicians, to governors, to the media about the issues at hand. And it never happened. Because people, they just go on Facebook and they talk about what they want to do, or they talk about their own issues. There's a lot of family members on Facebook that are not there for their sons or their daughters. They're there for themselves. And that's pretty sad, because if you have somebody going on Facebook and crying about their problems, doing nothing about it, or crying about what's happening with their loved ones and not doing anything about it, They're not really the resolution to the problem of their loved one. They're probably contributors to it. But the community, I wish the community would be more involved. But out of fear, from hearing what the Department of Corrections officials always talk about, or being victimized themselves, or knowing somebody that was victimized, I think that's what prevents them from wanting to get involved. What they don't realize is maybe their involvement might be one of the biggest benefits, the biggest positive things that can happen to the low recidivism rates and to the decrease in crime.
I mean, everyone plays a role in this big picture of trying to fix something that's broken. And those people that are complaining on Facebook, keep going. I mean, at least there's information out there and we're getting additional information. And for the people that can do something with that, maybe it's our job to just step it up and do what's necessary. But I think that what's been broken for so long is going to take a minute to get everybody on board. But once we put the information out there and make people aware and educate people, I think that this is going to be a powerful movement. We just have to collect all the necessary information out there. We have to find out what works, what doesn't, and what we could do with what works. So, I mean, eventually, you know, I feel that I'm a leader in my community, and as far as advocacy, I think that I think outside the box to where people are going to listen to what I have to say, and I'm going to lead a lot of people into fixing something, and I'm going to be part of something that's bigger than myself. So I think it's just important to that leaders of the communities, we come together and formulate a plan to come together. And until we could all come together and become one voice, these little voices are great. But, I mean, I'm in for, like, big haul. I want to see big changes. That's how I dream big. So I'm hoping. Well, I'm hoping that people jump on.
I think we all do. You know, Christine, I want to ask you, you're just a listener, I know, but what would you, I mean, you're not being a relative or anything to anyone who's been incarcerated, what would you think as a community member of what Lawrence is saying as far as getting the community involved?
I'm sorry, can you say that one more time?
I'd like to know your thoughts on it, because just putting you out in the community, as an individual out in the community, what would your thoughts be as to what Lawrence is saying? When we talk about the community getting involved and maybe preventing these things from happening, if you were a stranger out there in the community, what would your thoughts be about prisoners and about the community getting together to try to prevent crime by helping or by being a support to the prisoners or the offenders at the time?
If I wasn't aware of certain things, like with prisoners or inmates, my own personal opinion is, you know, they're just a person. They're a human being. I shouldn't be afraid of them. You know, they're just people. But knowing a lot of information, being his sister-in-law and having my husband being an ex-offender as well, you know, a lot of people get scared of what they are capable of. You know,
yeah.
Being in prison, they have so many avenues and so many pain that they go through. So it just depends on the person, but personally, I feel that they're just human beings who just want to be home with family, and they deserve every right.
You know, there was a time when I used to look at prisoners differently until it did happen in my situation. But people, I don't know, I just feel like people today, they don't even try to get to know more. Like you said, you became aware of it. Your husband was an ex. And I'll tell you, I found in some research I was doing, that I found that one in every five, I believe it is, one in every five people in this country have a family member or someone that they know that's incarcerated. That's a lot. One in every five, that's a lot to swallow in this country, because this is mass incarceration. And as we've been talking every week about Norway and Netherlands and Germany and places like that, with their recidivism rate is so low compared to our recidivism rate. And not only that, but they don't have mass incarcerations. They don't have life and life without parole sentencing. So when you talk, Lawrence, when you talk about the communities coming together and working on these issues, they have to, like Christine said, and they have to first get to know about what's going on.
Yeah. Well, I think the government's done a very good job of dividing us, especially the United States. They have this thing where like the Black Lives Matter movement, which is great, but, you know, they separated this class, and in just my opinion, that it's not a race thing. I think it's a poverty thing. And they've done their job in making us fight amongst each other to take the focus off of them from doing their jobs. And while they're getting richer, we're getting poorer. We're fighting amongst each other. We're dividing ourselves within division. And it's just, you know, I grew up in the barrio with blacks and Mexicans my whole life. And I grew up in the system with them. You know, I'm a white boy, and I got the same treatment as my brothers and sisters next to me of different races. So,
you know,
my experience is... Oh, go ahead.
No, I'm glad you said that, because I want to bring something up real quick. One of the things I noticed is when we talk about Black Lives Matter, we talk about the Hispanics, we talk about the Arabs, we talk about all these different races. And when we talk about the racism in this country, and I want to say this because, and I know people of different colors are going to probably not agree, or they're going to be upset. When they talk about the racism that they have to deal with the white man, they need to also look at themselves and think about how they treated their own people. You know, we have the dark blacks that don't want to be associated with the light-skinned blacks. We have the Hispanics
yeah.
who don't want to be related with the blacks. We have all this division within all these different racial cultures, but yet they want everybody to excuse that and forget about that and talk about these lives matter. If it's going to be Black Lives Matter, it's going to be all lives, all people of color. If it's going to be the White Lives Matter, let it be all whites. But don't try to cry out the racial injustice if you are going to have racial injustice against your own. And that's what I see happening. And it's just like with social status. You know, the wealthy talk about not wanting to help the poor. They don't have to help the poor because they got it already. They don't put themselves
yeah.
in their shoes. But we, like you say, this is a divided country. And everybody's
yeah.
crying and complaining about what's happening with their race or their culture. But they forget what they're treating when they're treating their own in that same manner.
Oh, absolutely. I think that's why the government's done such a great job in making us not focus on them, not focusing on their gas cards and their salary. And how is it everybody in Congress is rich, but yet they don't work? They just sit there and pass stuff. And it's just, you know, it's broken as it is, and it's just like the fall of Rome. You know, eventually it's going to fall. And right now we're getting people in power that, you know, like, for instance, Gascon in the L.A. district attorney, he's pushing for reform. And his own people, or the own sheriff, is sitting there talking out against him, saying that he's the voice for the victims. Well, to me, that's a conflict of interest, because he's supposed to be the voice of justice. He's supposed to
yeah.
uphold his job. And yet he's sitting there taking a side. And I think as soon as you say something like that, you should be recalled. You should not even be able to, because you can't perform your oath. So, and that, which is in the first, innocent until proven guilty. So I don't think that the things that's been set up, it's been set up for the rich. And I think that we're just getting poorer, and the middle class is falling back more and more every day. And we're dividing ourselves. And until we come together and as a whole and say, no, we're tired of this. We outnumber them, but yet they still keep us suppressed. They still, today, you know, in the prison system, slavery is still going on with all the races. It's not white, black, or Mexican. It's all of us. They are sitting there putting us to wages that are inhumane. They are putting us under conditions that are inhumane. It's the same thing. They took our right to vote. They took our right. And of course they're going to take our right to vote, because once they give us the power to vote, we have a voice. And so we are being oppressed today. There's modern day slavery going on today. And yet everybody wants to talk about the past. Let's talk about today, what's going on. And this
yeah.
is what they're doing to us behind those walls legally is just, it's modern day slavery. And so, you know, now that I have a voice and I can sit here and speak out against it, I do. You know, it may not be popular, but, you know, it's my truth. So, you know, the reason why Norway and all of them, they're so successful in the racism is because they invite a good environment, a healthy environment, where people aren't stabbing each other, where people go for help, where they go for therapy and treatment. California and the United States is not into that. They're into warehousing, and it's more money. It's worth more to keep an inmate locked up for 30, 40 years. And let's not get into the crimes that don't even permit that much time. Let's talk about the guy that stole a piece of pizza and did 30 years in prison with me. You know, that's wrong. And there's so much money. It's a lucrative business, and it's thriving right now. And that's the problem. Until they take the money out of the inmate, we're always going to have that business.
And, you know, the lawmakers, I would think that the lawmakers, they can't say they're not aware of what's going on in the prisons, because they get calls from the loved ones of prisoners all the time. They know all the injustice. They know that prisoners are being kept in solitary confinement, a lot of times for no reason at all, that they're on restrictive blocks, that their televisions are taken from them, their clothes, their books. They're being caged 22, 24 hours a day. We have lawmakers around this country that know these things happen. And we are looking at the community when we can't even get our own lawmakers to do something. If the community wants to help, that would be the first step, is to stop making mass calls, massive calls, to the media and to the politicians and to the governors. Because this is where it has to stop, with these solitary confinement, with these beatings, with these deprivations. Like I say all the time, prisoners are being set up. They're being deprived. They're being kept from taking programs. They're being, you know, caged, like just like animals, and treated like animals. Politicians need to be involved.
And the thing with recidivism is that they're investing into that. And the community, the poverty class does not see that, because they feel somehow they feel they're helpless or powerless. But the thing is that these people that are setting these up, what they're doing is they're creating an atmosphere where we come back. They know, you know, 9 out of 10 inmates are going to come back. So what they do is they want these harsh environments. They set us up from the gate, because the problems that we go in are that some of the same problems we come out with unless we rehabilitate ourselves. And sure, like California got so many millions of dollars for adding an R to their CDC for rehabilitation, but they're not, it's all for a ploy. It was all for a financial gain. There was no intent behind it. And now, you know, so they're investing into us coming back. They're not investing us to go get help. They're not setting things up, you know, to go somewhere to go get treatment. They're setting us to a place that's going to ensure their jobs and money in their pockets for us to keep helping them get rich. And that's why all the prisons have like packages, right? And so what ended up happening was these packages are set up by people that are invested into the system. So all these former COs, all these investors are former CDC officers. And so they make it to where we can only go through 4 packages throughout the whole state. And so they're called approved vendors. But who approves these vendors? Who's invested behind them? And why are they being pushed to where we have to go through them? It's a monopoly. And that's why I started the petition for that, because, you know, there's inside information that we as inmates know, and it's our job and our obligation to put that out there to the community for change, to sit there and make them aware of what we need to do next.
Yeah, there's so much that needs to be done, so much.
It's pretty bad when the union for the prisons are stronger than the governor. You know, the union had the power to elect Arnold Schwarzenegger and recall him. So that's just that tells you right there that that's how powerful their union is. But what the community doesn't realize is our union is more powerful as long as we could come together and form one.
You know, you mentioned what you wanted to do as far as going into the prisons and talking with the prisoners and working with them. I don't know. I mean, that's probably further down the road. But I agree with you. I agree that something needs to be done while they are in prison. And one of the things I think is that they need a transitional program from prison to transitional to the communities. And in these transitional facilities, they can have, you know, the occupational therapist, you know, they can have all these people helping them with their resumes, helping them with their, you know, getting themselves together, be to presentable to go to these places. And like I said before, when I was years ago, I used to help the prisoners with their resumes, those that were coming out, and I would write a letter, a generic letter, which they could take to the thrift shops, and asking that they allow them to pick out a certain amount of clothing and things so that they can be presentable when they take their resumes. Some of these prisoners would take them to the thrift shops, and they would give them up to $40 or $50 worth of free clothing. And these are some of the things that don't cost anybody money. When we have all these organizations receiving all this money to do all these things, and you don't see anything being done, you know where the money's going. It's not going into the resources. It's going into the pockets of those who are running it. And right now, these people need a transition. They can't be released just to the streets. They need to be released with a mentor. If it has to be someone like yourself, if it has to be transitioning to a facility, and then from that facility, you can go in with your crew and you can start, you know, working with them to prepare them for the outside and to try to get them work and every education or whatever else they need to come out into the communities.
Well, and one of the things that Legacy Programs Education and Reentry that I'm starting is providing a life coach with for every reentry inmate. And my thing is we're, like my mentor tells me, we're addressing real needs. We're informing the community about the condition that we come out with and what needs to be addressed and what's needed for a proper reentry within the community. Because we're talking about real people, we're talking about real issues, and who can, and we're asking if part of the community who can meet these needs. And we're given awareness and given the condition of the inmate and how they could help rather than shun them and put them in a state of mind where they think they have to commit another crime to come back. Because that's what they've done, is they created this fear where it disconnected us as a community and offenders to where they can't reach out because they have a fear of being victimized. And I blame the media for that because they're not promoting anything good about reentry. They're only promoting the violence and they're feeding into recidivism for their ratings. And that's a lot of it. I blame them, and I think that bringing an awareness to the community is important. And I think some of these organizations they probably had the right intention at first, and I think they just lost their way. And so I think that they all have potential into coming back to the table to figure out what they could do for the reentry. But I think that it's just going to take a little bit of bringing them back from being lost to really be effective going to the future. So, but like my program, we offer life coaches. We are talking about going into the jails before they get out. We're talking about going in there a year and a half before they get they're released. That way we give them the tools and set them up for success, and we bring them back into not just society but into the community. And by doing that, we have to inform the conditions that how we're conditioned within those walls. And let me tell you something. Today, I have issues going into grocery stores. I have emotional breakdowns. I have a disconnect from people where I'll hide out in my room, and it takes my pastor's wife to sit there and say, hey, you want something to eat? To this day, I have an issue going in the refrigerator because I'm waiting for somebody to tell me that it's time to go eat. I'm waiting for somebody to say, hey, there's food right here. Why don't you come eat? They're not calling chow. Every day at count time, I sit on my bunk or my bed, sorry, and I think about there's something, what am I supposed to be doing? Until I realize it's count time. So these are the conditions that we have, you know, feeling less than, unlovable, not good enough, coming back into society, and nobody's addressing those real needs of saying, hey, I love you, let's go. You did your time, let's try to get you back on board. They're feeding into the fear and the uncertainty of the media and the government to sit there and, oh yeah, you're going to go back to prison.
You know, what you just said is so true. I've heard that from so many prisoners who have gotten out. One wife told me one time that her husband, he got out, he was from Ohio, got out of prison and spent mostly every single day, the time they were married, in his room. He was afraid to come out of his room because he was so used to being in a small section of the prison. And all of these things that you were mentioning is like they didn't know when to do anything for themselves. That's how much psychological damage is done to so many prisoners while incarcerated. It's sad. It really is.
Well, and that's why we at Legacy address real needs, not some bullshit like they do right now, excuse my language, of, oh, we're going to give them this program. No, the program's great, but if without guidance, how can you tell a child to clean his room if he doesn't know how to clean his room? And a lot of people that are being incarcerated aren't familiar with the self-help and aren't familiar with the changing. So they get a little piece of it, but they don't get the full amount from it because they don't understand it. So it takes somebody to go back to explain to them, hey, I sat in that chair. This was my process. Let me help you begin your process. And I'm going to do transitional housing. I'm setting it up right now. I started the business. Hopefully get my 501(c) status before the end of the year. I have a business, a contract with somebody for transitional housing, and they build little homes, and we're going to do this. And I'm going to take on all the people that were former inmates to help me with this, because I think it's important that our message gets across that we can be saved. We are human beings. Our needs are going to be met one way or another. So why not do it the right way? And we're going to go forward. We're going to be impactful.
And as you mentioned earlier, it's almost like going for counseling to see a psychologist isn't good. It isn't helpful for you. And it may not be for a lot of prisoners. So when you start the transitional program for prisoners coming out, then maybe the most beneficial thing instead of psychological help would be group therapy. I mean, group sessions and individual sessions. A lot of times, people coming together who have all gone through the same thing, you know yourself, are more helpful to one another than a psychologist can possibly be.
Oh, yeah. And I think that's why a life coach is necessary in this process, because it has somebody walking alongside you and not somebody just over you saying you need to do this, this, and that, and a third. I'm putting somebody side by side to go every step with you. And, you know, when I sat in therapy, I just wanted somebody to say, I know what you're going through. I understand. And I needed guidance. I needed somebody to say, well, here's a suggestion how to get up out of it. Not no clinical answer. I want a real life answer. I want a real life solution. And I want to see, when I look at somebody, I could tell where they're at right now from where they've been. I have an idea when they share. And I wanted somebody to say, hey, you know what? There's hope for you, kid. And this is what we're going to do for you. But instead, they just said, tell me how you feel. You know, how does that make you feel? And yeah, it's great for emotional intelligence. But if I can't identify the emotions I'm going through and I don't have that education, really, how much help is it? And that's just my standpoint on that. So I want somebody to walk with me, not to sit with me and give and just throw out some suggestions that they don't know anything about.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, you say you don't have education, but you've got more education than someone that went to college for 4 years, you know, to get a degree in psychology or something like that. But the life experience, I think life experiences is education because you're living it. So many people are going to college and getting that piece of paper in different areas, but they don't have any experience. And a piece of paper to me is not any good unless you have been there and done it and overcame it.
Yeah. Well, and I think that, you know, in prison, the some of the education I had was I grew up on the level 4 prison at 18 and went through a 180 and a 270, which are security. The high 180 is like one of the highest, and before you hit the SHU program. The thing is that I learned how to judge somebody within 15 seconds. I could read body language. I could tell if this person, I could feel things where if my life is in danger or if this person's a threat. I learned how to talk to people. Even if I didn't like you, I got along with you. And that's one thing we did in prison. You know, we came together when we needed to. But at the end of the day, we, at any point, we could go to war with each other, you know. So it was one of those things that my education dealing with the MA population was a whole psychological trip, you know, 20 years of experience, of because it's very mentally based environment. It's only the strong survive. And the ones that don't make it is because it was just too much for them to handle. So
you had mentioned the last time you were on the show, you mentioned that some of those prisoners serving life and life without parole sentences are more likely to succeed or not reoffend if they were to be given the chance, the opportunity. And I find that to be true, too, because there are so many people who have been in prison for years. And they're doing good. And others that are trying to do good are being prevented from doing good. So by the overseers, who, by the way, I always look at as being criminals themselves in uniform and getting away with it.
Oh, yeah. Well, less than 1% of people that do 15 to 20 years are coming back to prison. You know, the safest person you could have in your neighborhood is a lifer. But yet a lifer has to go through another step just to get out, which the governor sits there and puts these people in charge of a board, a parole hearing. The parole hearing has a psychologist and two psychologists and all this these speed bumps and these hoops to jump through. They finish it, and then the governor just sits there and goes, you know what? Yeah, I'm trying to get reelected. I can't let you out. And so it's
that's it.
It's so
that's
backwards.
It. You know,
but
it's
yet,
sad.
But, you know, go ahead.
No, you go.
Oh, it's just unfortunate that they give these kids life sentences when they have hallmarks of a youth. You know, they sit there and say, you could go serve your country at 18 years old and enjoy in the military, but you can't smoke buy a pack of cigarettes until you're 21 now. And so it's when is a man a man? When is an adult? And they're giving these kids and these young men and women these harsh-ass sentences that are just they have no idea what they're doing. And they're not going somewhere where it helps them. They're going somewhere where it conditions them. And the conditioning in the prisons right now are animal-like. They're inhumane. So, you know, the life sentences, how can you tell somebody, especially for not even taking a life, that you got 50, 60 years? To me, anything 20 years is a life sentence.
Yeah.
Because that most of the time, I mean, 20 years in prison is a long time. But I just think that they have to have more compassion. But the thing is that the inmate population is worth so much money today, it's more beneficial for them to put these kids and these young men and women in prison and keep them away and just keep conditioning them to keep coming back to keep fueling to keep padding their pockets.
Yeah. You mentioned when do they say a kid is a kid and an adult is an adult? You know, that's the problem in this country, is that they want them to be children when they want them to be children, and they want them to be men when they want them to be men, like joining the military, you know, even school. When they talk about the age responsibility or the responsibility of the age group or whatever, it should be as long as they're in high school and in college, as long as they're in the most time is usually 4 to 6 years. So they should allow them to be just what they are, students, just what they are, young people who should not be sent to adult prisons if they commit a crime. they want, even in the homes of a lot of people in this country, you have these parents that want their kids to do something that's adult at one minute, and then they treat them like children in another. And it can't be, they can't have it both ways, because all they're going to do is confuse their loved ones, their children. And that's what happens a lot.
Yeah, well, and the fact that when these children, you don't really start thinking about life choices and decisions until you're in your 30s, at least for a male. You know, I didn't get my life together until I was 32 and started seeing the consequences of a choice and decision. I didn't see the big picture of what can happen. I thought, I was already conditioned from the system ahead of time to where I was, they call it institutionalized, or there's the, for the youth, where you're always stuck at some age.
Uh-huh.
And I think that when the system set, it's almost like the system sets you up, and there's no oversight, there's no accountability for the system, and they just keep you, you just go through one step to another, just on different levels. And so when these kids are making this, look, not everyone needs to go to prison. Not everyone should have to live and endure that psychological trip. I think some people deserve to be in prison. Absolutely. I think there's good and bad in everyone. But at the same time, why are we putting somebody in a penal code where we're not taking into account their upbringing, their psychological trauma, or nothing like that? And so some people, yeah, prison's a good environment for them because they need to be there, but some people just need help. They need to be part of a community. They need to be part of a healthy environment. Like, for instance, coming to live with my pastor, this is the first time I've ever sat at a table at dinner time and prayed. This is the first time that I've been in an environment where it's safe, where I have privacy, where I have respect and love and encouragement. I mean, how could you not grow in this environment? So I think everyone should have the experience of a Nielsen Inn. That's what we call it here. But if I would have had that instead of prison, instead of coming out with all these preconditions, I think I would be a lot more successful today than what I am.
And then if you did have something like that, and you got in a relationship with somebody that's not into that and has never been into that, and there's a relationship that occurs, and then all of a sudden you're dating somebody that's going to either try to bring you out of that environment, that healthy environment, or somebody that's going to destroy it. It's a catch-22 in some cases. But you're right. This is what they need to do. They need to have it in all the homes. It's like years ago when I was a kid going to school, they had the national anthem. They had the prayers in the schools. You know, and they took the prayers out of school. Why? You know, when they get on the football and they got this Super Bowl or whatever coming up, when they get out there, I mean, you got people all over the country and parts of the world watching it, cheering it on, you know, praising it. And here we have our creator who doesn't even get that kind of attention, and he's the one that created the entire world. People have their priorities in the wrong places.
Well, and I think it's just we've been divided by something bigger than ourselves right now, and we're allowing people to play us like puppets. I see it, and it's just unfortunate the way that it is. And the only way we can fight it and to bring it is just to bring an awareness and an education about it. And that takes when you imprison me for 20 years, you damn right I got a message to say when I get out. I have a voice now. And,
yeah.
You know, it's important for everybody, at least, you know, you don't have to agree with everything I say, but at least listen and take into account that in some way, shape, or form, one of your loved ones is going through that. I mean, we, in prison, we all go through the same crap, some more than others, but we all go through the same issues, just at different degrees. And, you know, it takes brave people like my sister-in-law. You know, when I got out, they first thing they did was, hey, you need a car. So they went out and looked for a car for me. When I sat there and said, hey, I need this for my podcast. They got me a microphone. My brother, you know, him and his wife looked out for me immensely. And I always have that. Huh?
That is what people need when they're incarcerated. They need their family support. And, you know, the sad thing is, like I said, there are so many people in prison who don't have it. Their families either turned a blind eye and walked away or something. They weren't there for them then, and they weren't there for them when they went out. And these are sad situations. So your situation is unique because you had a brother and a sister-in-law that stood by you when you came out.
Well, I also had a family member, my own mother, actually, that tried to divide us and keep us apart. My mother was my sister-in-law and my brother were trying to send me packages and money and wanted to take care of me and give me my needs in prison. And my own mother sat there and said, no, I'll take care of it. And then the whole time she's lying to him.
Jeez.
So, you know, yeah. So, you know, that's the other thing is people need to just go out and do it. You know, if you feel something in your heart, don't let somebody hold you back because you don't know what truths lie, you know, behind that statement. You don't know what facts are there. So it's best to just go forward. And, you know, I got a great support network. I have, and also, you know, I want to give a huge shout out to Premier Pharmacy because they listen. And I just want to say, hey, good afternoon, y'all. And thank you for tuning in. You got a lot of people just from that one phone call. And also the Haynes School that works with the disability, the autism, children with autism. And I do interviews with them, like they ask questions and stuff like that. So I encourage you all to ask questions and to express yourselves and to get those answers because they're out there. We just have to take the charge to go get them. And with what you do afterwards with that is all on you. You know, I can only hope and pray that you take that information and you make a difference in your community. And when you see a former inmate, don't look at him as a potential perpetrator, but look at him as somebody that just needs help and look at him as part of your community. And that, let's see, you know, every inmate's different, of course. But, you know, use your judgment. Be a little vulnerable. Put yourself out there and see what you get from it. You know, because they say, you know, whatever direction you move with God behind it, everything's going to – it's going to reveal itself.
That's it.
So.
And I want to say, Lawrence, we have a couple of minutes. I want – if you can, give the audience your contact information, your website or whatever you have there. And then next Sunday, we can talk more on these issues that you're talking about now. But for now, can you just give the audience all the information and anyone that wants to do any volunteer work with you or get in contact with you, how they can do that?
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you. So you could get a hold of me. My Gmail is Lawrence Drenk, LawrenceDrenk. I also have Legacy Programs Education and Reentry on Facebook, and I have Legacy Programs on there as well. And you could hit me up as Sparky Lee from Georgia. So, and we're right now. I got my business of Legacy Programs Education and Reentry that we're looking for grant writers. We're trying to get a 501(c) by the end of this year. We're working on transitional housing, and if any of you are interested in helping. Any role you play is essential and it's appreciated.
And I want to say real quickly, there is, if you type in the internet browser sometimes, they used to have government surplus government that they would give away to various organizations and things. I don't know if they still do it, but again, it's surplus government properties that maybe you can use or find some kind of facilities out in the communities that are no good, the windows are broken out, they're not using it or whatever, and try to see if they would be willing to donate it to a nonprofit. But again, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for being on. Christine, I want to thank you and your husband for supporting, right now, supporting Lawrence. And also Samantha, I want to give her a holler and just to let her know that she's always remembered as well. But I thank all
thank
of you,
you
for being on, and I hope next Sunday we'll have you back on again, and we can talk more about this. Thank you so much, Laura.
Thank you, Leona, for this platform and for all the stuff you do. You are essential in this world and this fight ahead. Thank you.
Well, people like yourself are very rare, unique, because a lot of times people come out and they don't do anything more with their lives, but you came out and you're doing a big thing. I'm just proud of you. So I'm thanking everyone for being on, and we look forward to Lawrence and his loved ones being on again next week. We're signing out now, everyone, and have a blessed day.
Thank you. God bless y'all. Bye.